from West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for the legislature today is provided by the following.
AARP West Virginia, your ally for real possibilities in the Mountain State. Online at aarp.org/WV. West Virginia University, online at wvu.edu.
At the legislature today, tax reform is the hot-button issue at the State House as both chambers struggle with ways to shift the tax burden without causing an even larger budget gap. In the Senate, members vote to end the transfer of funds from casino games used to support the Greyhound racing industry, while in the House, delegates vote to create a new inventory of state vehicles. And we take a detailed look at the latest bill proposed to make changes to leasing in the oil and gas industry. Those stories and more coming up on the legislature today. Good evening, I'm Ashton Mara. Delegates are spending the early evening debating a couple of bills that make some major changes to both the state's sales and income taxes. Both of those bills are on second reading, the amendment phase, in the House tonight. Liz McCormick joins us with more. Liz, thank you for being here.
Of course.
Let's start with House Bill 2816. This is a governor's bill. Go over for us generally. What does this bill do?
Right. So this bill does a few things. The title of it is that it eliminates the film tax credit, but it actually does a couple other things. By eliminating the film tax credit, it would put $5 million back into general revenue. It also would end a transfer that's currently going into the state road fund, which would put $12 million back into general revenue. And it also increases the beer barrel tax, which is estimated to bring in an additional $3 million, and all of that would go to general revenue.
So this was the governor's bill to increase a whole host of taxes. It would have brought in about, I think, $450 million, according to the fiscal note. It was changes to the sales tax and the business, I think a commercial activities tax, a bunch of things included in there. Tonight, it's up for amendment on the floor, and there are a couple of those presented by Delegate Butler at this point. He's the only one that's got two listed on the system. Tell us about those pending amendments.
Yeah, so Delegate Jim Butler, a Republican from Mason County, has two pending amendments, as you said. One of those increases the sales tax 6.5%. That would begin on July 1st of 2017, but it has a sunset effect by June 30th of 2020, but that's only if the year before in 2019, the rainy day fund is equal to 15% of general revenue. So that's the first amendment. He has a second amendment that would create a commercial activity tax, which would put a 0.2% tax on gross income of businesses, and that also has the same sunset date as the other one.
The same sunset, so could also come off in 2020 if the state's rainy day fund is at 15% of the general revenue budget. There's also House Bill 2933. This one has been introduced by Delegate Riley Moore from the Eastern Panhandle. Tell us about what that bill does.
Yeah, this bill does a lot of different things, but sort of in a nutshell, it lowers the rate of the sales and use tax, but it also would broaden the amount of things that are going to be taxed over a period of time, sort of starting 2017 and by 2020. So kind of looking at some of those things, October 1st of 2017, a sales tax would be put on things like cell phones, daycare services, some personal and professional services. And then also at that time, it would reinstate a 3% grocery or food tax. And then looking at January 1st, 2018, more things would be taxed, more exemptions lifted. And also looking at that same date, January 1st, 2018, it would bring a flat rate on the personal income tax of about 5.1%. And then July 1st, 2018, the sales tax would then be lowered from the current 6% to 5%. And so kind of looking at all the monies in those each of those years, we're looking 2018, $172 million. 2019, $29 million, and then by 2020, $11 million.
Those are additional revenues brought in each year, and that's because there's a major portion of the bill that actually lowers the rate of the personal income tax. It puts in a flat rate at 5.1%. Right now, personal income tax is tiered. I guess people pay anywhere from 3 to 6.5%. Mm-hmm. A couple of amendments, well, quite a few amendments proposed for this one this evening, 16 on the list. Name a couple of them. What do those proposed amendments do?
Yeah, so some of those are exemption related, so kind of bringing some exemptions back onto some different areas. A couple of those, they're looking at a Social Security one that would take the tax or have an exemption on Social Security benefits. Another one would be exempting retirement, veterans retirement, and another one would be on retired school teachers and public employees.
Liz McCormick, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Senators this morning delayed consideration of their tax reform measure. The latest iteration of the bill was held over in the Finance Committee after questions were raised about the bill's financial implications for both the middle class and the state budget as a whole. The delay comes as senators are running up on a deadline to vote on their own bills.
Senate Bill 409 is the latest in a number of tax reform measures presented to senators this session. The bill would increase the sales tax from 6 to 7% in October of this year, getting rid of several exemptions on services, and implements a 3.5% tax on groceries. In January 2018, the bill would also restructure the state's personal income tax. The current tax structure is tiered based on income, and West Virginians pay anywhere from 3 to 6.5%. The new bill creates three tax rates. Anyone making $25,000 or less would pay at a rate of 1.75%. From $25,000 to $35,000 would pay 3.5%. And anyone who makes more than $35,000 a year would pay 5.25%. The bill, which was largely written by Charleston attorney Mike Carl, then sets an economic benchmark to eventually repeal the personal income tax altogether.
In any tax year following a fiscal year in which for each $50 million by which the combined collections of the sales and use taxes exceed $1.8 billion, then the rates of each of those brackets would come down at 0.1%, 0.1%, until they're reduced to zero.
There is no way, Carl says, for that 0.1% in personal income tax to be reassessed under the bill. Liz Perdue is acting director of the research division in the state tax department. She presented the estimated revenue impacts to lawmakers and says when the bill is fully implemented, it will result in a net loss of income for the state.
We're looking at a net increase FY18 of roughly $61 million. The FY19 estimate is a reduction of about $91 million. And just to take it out one more year so you'd have an idea, FY2020 is looking at about $127 million in the negative.
Democratic Senator Doug Faismeyer says he's not sure why lawmakers are considering the measure. He questioned Carl.
Here's where I'm having my problem. I'll give you the first year because we net out $61 million. Now, what is your all's plan for us to recoup the deficits that start in year two? 91 million, then 127 million? Well, what's the plan to recoup that money back?
I can just give you my personal opinion. I believe that the revenues will grow.
Carl says the shift from the personal income to a sales and use tax will result in a stronger economy for West Virginia. In the process, Faismeyer notes, the bill places a larger tax burden on the middle class, people who make between $25,000 and $100,000 per year. Kanawha County Senator Corey Palumbo questioned Perdue about the implications of the income tax changes.
Have you guys analyzed how this would impact different people in different income brackets? Just the full sum of the changes. I mean, obviously, you know, most people are going to have some benefit in the changes to the income tax system. But, I mean, it's going to be offset somewhat or more than any benefit, the increase in the sales tax and the elimination of those exemptions.
Absolutely. We have looked into that, and I apologize. I don't think I have that paper in front of me. I believe we were seeing, for some individuals, not for all, we were seeing a bit of a reduction in the incomes below about $25,000 and above about $100,000 in taxable income. And then in between $25,000 to $100,000, we were seeing an increase. But I would not have those numbers specifically. We could certainly provide those for you, though.
Okay, so you're saying an increase in their tax liability. So basically this
yes.
will help people below $25,000 and above $100,000, and
yes.
it would hurt in some level people from $25,000 to $100,000.
Yes.
Senator Faismeyer again spoke against the bill.
The bottom line is we're not helping the low wage people. We're putting all the burden on the middle class. We're helping the people that makes over $100,000, and in doing all that, we're going to cause ourselves close to a $100 million deficit next year. Why would we even waste our time with a bill like this?
Ultimately, the committee decided to push consideration of the bill off to a future meeting because of the number of questions about its fiscal impact. The bill has been read the first of three times required under legislative rules before it can be put to a vote, but that vote has to come before crossover day Wednesday. That's the last time senators can vote on bills that started in their chamber.
Senators voted today to end the Greyhound Breeding Development Fund. The fund currently takes dollars made from table and video lottery games at racetrack casinos in Nitro and Wheeling and returns the money to the greyhound racing industry to pay for breeding and winnings on bets. The bill ending that fund takes $15 million in lottery revenue and allows them to be appropriated elsewhere in the state budget. Here's a look at some of the debate on the floor today.
And another thing that I've heard a lot about is this is a tax. We're using taxpayer dollars to go to these dogs. We're using my money, my taxpayer dollars, to go directly to paying for these dogs. Well, I took a look through everything here on the abstract of where the development fund, what it's coming from. And it's all dealing with things played at the track, the lottery revenue, machines, the table games. So, yeah, it's a tax, if you want to call it that, but it comes from the revenue that's generated at the casino. It doesn't come from the tax on if you buy a suit jacket. It doesn't come from the tax on if you buy a car. So unless you go to the casino and you wager there, you're not paying into it.
This year, we're actually looking at another swipe at higher education. We're looking at a possible swipe at public education and putting more of a burden on property owners. We're looking at possibly a swipe at Medicaid, something we've never done in the past. Now, I'm not sure about everybody else in this body, but for me, I can't go home with a clear conscience and look at my constituents in the eye and tell them that I'm going to subsidize a sporting gambling event instead of trying to make whole public education, higher education, the sick, and the elderly.
We're essentially doing away with an entire industry with over 1,700 full-time jobs directly related to the Greyhound racing, 775 part-time jobs. Indirectly, they also support vets, feed stores, suppliers. These are small family-run farms and businesses. You know, again, I worry that we're being penny-wise and pound-foolish. And I'm just not sure that the potential $15 million, if that's what it was, is going to be worth the loss of other jobs and loss of income.
Let's just be frank and blunt and transparent from the beginning. We don't need taxpayers' money subsidizing an industry that, by definition, does not create prosperity. It's regressive. It sucks money from the poor. It sucks money out of the market that otherwise would go to things of productivity. Let's be transparent again. Dog racing's popularity has gone to the dogs. It's nosedived over the years. It's but a fraction and a shadow of what it once was. West Virginia's future is not in subsidizing losing ventures like these.
We're here today looking at this today, well in advance of the budget, but what we're actually looking at here today is we're going to choose today to fund the dogs, or tomorrow we're going to choose to cut senior funding. We're going to choose today to cut the dogs, or tomorrow we're going to cut education. We're here today to choose whether or not we cut the dogs or cut Medicaid. This is a simple choice. It's the dogs or your kids. It's the dogs or mom and dad. It's the dogs or somebody who needs some medical help that won't get it because we didn't cut the dogs.
A lot of these dog breeders are from my area, and these aren't people that live in big fancy houses and things of that nature. They just work to survive. I love how right now we're talking about how we don't want to take anything out of the mouths of children. But, you know, once again, what have we done since we've been here for the last month and a half? We've attacked wage bonds. We've attacked medical monitoring. But now everybody wants to get all up and mighty about the dogs. Come on, people. This will hurt people in my area. It will.
The Senate ultimately approved the bill to end the Greyhound Breeders Fund on a 19-15 vote. It will now be considered by the House of Delegates. Tomorrow, senators will vote on yet another controversial piece of legislation that sparked hours of discussion in the chamber's Judiciary Committee. Senate Bill 576 has taken several forms in the chamber so far this session and deals with leasing agreements in the oil and gas industry. Joining me this evening to help us understand this bill are two interested parties. Tom Huber is the vice president of the West Virginia Royalty Owner Association. Ann Blankenship is the executive director of the West Virginia Oil and Natural Gas Association. Thank you both for being with me this evening.
Thank you.
So, Ann, let's start with you. Give me a basic overview. What does 576 do?
So really, Senate Bill 576 is about creating jobs and bringing an investment in the state by allowing really the full development of the oil and gas that we have. Because right now, in order to fully develop, you need 100% of the mineral owner's consent before you can do that. And it really is getting us out of line with other states. And so Senate Bill 576 is really a recurring attempt to change and update our laws so that even when we have less than 100% interest owner, you can still fully develop the oil and gas.
So there are two terms that keep coming up with this bill, co-tenancy and joint development. I'd like for you just to define those terms for us. Tom, why don't we start with you? What is co-tenancy? What does that mean?
All right, so co-tenancy deals with an individual tract of land and the oil and gas underneath. You could have hundreds of owners because these come down in airships. So you have to lease currently every single one of those people because of a court decision called Law v. Heck. What co-tenancy seeks to do is say, once you reach a certain threshold, and in this bill, it's 75%, if you still have non-consenting owners, that those owners can be drilled, and it sets a mechanism of compensation.
So they're drilled, but they still have to be paid. So then what's joint development?
Joint development is where a gas company may have a 100-year-old lease before pooling and unitization really existed. So they have the right to drill. They hold that with an old well production. Joint development says you can combine that lease with an adjacent lease to form a unit and drill your horizontal well.
So, and these two provisions, how are they different than forced pooling? That's the term that's come up for the past several legislative sessions. How is this different than forced pooling?
Sure, and that is the term that we've heard and have heard over the past few years. This is different. It's coming at it from a different angle to address the same issue. So forced pooling is a different bill, and it looks at it by a unit instead of by each tract. So if you want to compare forced pooling to co-tenancy, co-tenancy looks at the interest owners in each individual tract, and there are multiple tracts that make up a unit. So it really is looking at it from a different perspective. Forced pooling, again, is a mechanism to deal with the same issue where you don't have 100% of your mineral owners, but it's done in a different way. So it's a term of art for sure, but this year the mechanism that we're using in Senate Bill 576 is co-tenancy and joint development.
Tom, and the other term, sorry, go ahead.
I want to jump in there because we have a little different perspective on this. I've called this forced leasing and forced pooling in the past. I mean, in the bill we talk about non-consenting owners. I mean, if you're non-consenting, you're forced. The difference here is you're dealing with a different set of correlative rights. If I'm a majority co-tenant and I want to develop my minerals and the minority co-tenant is just saying no and holding it up, they're also depriving me of my right to benefit from my property. And on the joint development side, you know, the gas companies have won a court case in Tyler County saying they have the implied right to pool already. So this is a little different. The traditional forced pooling that most people think of, it deals with people that don't have a lease or maybe own 100% of their ownership. So in that respect, it's different. There's no commission deciding these things. So it's a little bit more nuanced.
Now, you're two groups, obviously, and you represent the industry, Tom representing royalty owners, but you all have come together in this bill. Both of your groups now support it. So, Anne, why don't we start with you? Why does industry like this bill?
You know, this bill is really key to our future success here in West Virginia. As I mentioned earlier, right now, the way that our law stands, we're just out of step with our surrounding states. West Virginia is one of only three mineral-producing states that doesn't have some sort of co-tenancy or joint development bill or statute in place. It makes more sense for some of our oil and gas companies to choose one of our surrounding states because it just makes more sense on a business scale because our laws are not in line and updated in order to take full advantage of the advances in technology that have occurred over the last few years. So it's very important.
Why do the royalty owners like this bill?
All right, so initially we've opposed previous iterations of this bill. And our concern is, are we going to lose negotiating power to get a good deal? We want to develop our minerals. We want to receive these royalties that could change your life in some cases. And one of our biggest issues that we felt needed to be addressed were post-production expenses. We've seen royalty checks that are in the negative because of post-production expenses. I know that sounds almost crazy, but that's what our biggest fear is. And currently, there is a court case that could really hurt us. It's called the Leggett versus EQT case in front of the Supreme Court that we're very concerned that we could lose. And lots of people with old leases could have those deductions taken from their future royalties. So the compromise here is we give on joint development and co-tenancy, and what we get is no post-production expenses on new wells drilled under the joint development and choices for payment on the co-tenancy part that are very advantageous to the non-consenting owner. For some groups, this isn't enough. We're aware of that, but from our standpoint as the Royalty Owners Association, we feel that it's a very good deal and we're trying to pass this bill.
Yeah, and we just have a couple seconds left, but this is a compromise. That part of it, the industry said, we can give up those post-production deductions in order to get this legislation through.
That's right. This bill is very important to us, and we have been able to make some compromises, and that's been one of them. You know, we've been involved in stakeholder negotiations now for weeks since the beginning of the session, and have worked very hard and tirelessly with Tom's group and with other groups so that we can find a middle ground. We really do want this to be fair to all involved. There's a lot of different interest owners involved, from the mineral owners to the surface owners, and we are working hard, the industry is working hard, to try to make it fair for everyone involved.
Anne Blankenship and Tom Hubert, thank you both so much.
Thanks
for having me.
We go to the House floor now, where delegates voted on 12 pieces of legislation today, including one that creates a central state vehicle inventory system. Liz McCormick reports the bill was the result of both an interim legislative study and a request from Governor Jim Justice.
One of the first bills to be presented to lawmakers on behalf of Governor Justice was to create and maintain a vehicle inventory system for state cars. That bill was introduced and sent to the House's Committee on Government Organization, but the committee decided instead to push their own version of that bill, House Bill 2004, which was up for a vote in the chamber today. The goal of that bill is to figure out just how many cars the state owns. According to the Legislative Auditor's Office, that's a difficult question to answer, and the number depends on who you ask. The Auditor's Office estimates West Virginia owns anywhere between 7,600 to 12,600 vehicles. The bill keeps in code many of the same measures that are in law today, but essentially starts the inventory from scratch. It says all of the data and information about state vehicles would be housed under one roof with the current Fleet Management Office. The inventory system would still distinguish state, county, and city vehicles with different color plates. House Government Organization Chair Delegate Gary Howell is the lead sponsor of House Bill 2004.
What this bill will do is begin to get a handle on it. We're changing the color of the license plates on it to get the old green ones out of the system because we know that some of those tags have disappeared and may be on private cars and stuff like that. Plus, we'll have reporting data on the mileage and the usage of them that we can later use to develop a program to see, you know, if cars are really needed. And I think we're going to find that a lot of vehicles are not needed, and we're probably going to save the taxpayer millions of dollars over the coming years.
Howell says new state vehicle license plates will be gold with blue letters. The plates on county and city-owned vehicles would remain the same, red with white letters for counties and blue with white lettering for municipalities. Howell says by creating the new inventory, the state will be able to track spending more closely.
We know where our personal vehicles are. We know how much we have in them. We know what our maintenance costs are. We know how much we're buying on fuel. And when times are tough, we track that. We decide, is this trip needed and stuff like that. The state should be doing the same thing. And when you don't know what you have, you can't do that.
The bill passed 99-0 in the House and now heads to the Senate for consideration. For the legislature today, I'm Liz McCormick in the House.
Tomorrow on our show, the president of the state's largest university will discuss the impact potential budget cuts could have on West Virginia's higher education system. Dr. E. Gordon Gee, president of West Virginia University, joins us on WVU's Lobbying Day at the Capitol. This has been the Legislature Today. I'm Ashton Mara. Thanks for joining us.
Support for the Legislature Today is provided by the following.
AARP West Virginia, your ally for real possibilities in the Mountain State. Online at aarp.org/WV. West Virginia University. Online at wvu.edu. From West Virginia Public Broadcasting.